Hello and welcome to No Killing Goblins. We're the Wandering In podcast, and despite how, why am I still so bad at this? Anyways, this is my co-host, Oshi, and we're here to talk about Wandering In again today.
You had to pause to let me speak when you said co-host. You know what? You are bad at this. Hi, everybody.
I don't know what it is. It's like every time I just go to say, well, I feel like I need to say something different, but I also need to introduce us, and how many different ways are there for, like, us to introduce ourselves?
Let's figure it out. We could pull a Trash Taste and have a different intro, or do a Joey or something. We could name our audience. I don't know.
I really don't want to know what name we would come up with for our audience.
I mean, there's already a ready-made one for the Discord, folks. Ducks.
True.
Hello, my little ducks!
I mean, yeah, that's really all the Wandering In fans. Don't exclude the Redditors now. Actually, didn't that joke come from Reddit? Are we, like, appropriating Reddit's name by stealing that?
Fuck Reddit. Fuck Reddit. They don't have a podcast. They don't know shit.
Okay, fuck Reddit then, I guess. And to anybody who clicked on this link from the Reddit, I guess you're not welcome anymore.
I haven't posted on Reddit in forever. You're supposed to be doing posting, too, and I'm too tired to, like, give a shit about posting on Reddit.
Oh, I mean, just let me know when I can post it. I just, for some reason, I thought that you were already doing it, so I will go ahead and fix that.
I am too lazy to do it. We've already talked. Okay, let's go back to the end.
We're awful at this. So, how's your week been, Oshi?
I thought we would talk about books before we attacked Oshi with "Why is your life not perfect?" Dragonus, come on.
I mean, I'm struggling to think about books because I'm just so deep in the animes right now.
Okay, so my week was actually pleasant. I felt useful for once. I don't know how else to say it. I felt genuinely useful in my life, with helping my family, with helping myself. Whether or not that translates into a decent holiday season, we will see. You know Thanksgiving's coming. Like, it's like the monster in the window that's getting bigger and bigger.
My Thanksgivings are all mostly canceled at this point. I usually go up to a friend of mine's place for the last few years where he does, like, a big Friendsgiving thing and play some board games and hang out up there. But that's canceled. I don't feel like going all the way up to Pennsylvania to see the rest of my family. There's some family in Florida I wanted to go see, but, like, I also don't feel like that long drive, so I'm just going to stay home, tell my job that I'm traveling, and unplug everything.
Okay. The reason that was you got an okay is because I was looking for the email that Discanter, our editor, sent us, because I told him to, because he had something of a comment about the episode where we talked about Ryoka and her saving of Mercia during the whole the sacrifice of the Fae stuff.
Yeah.
So, let me go through it. So, Discanter says oh my god, I just went into the ACD voice. Guys, sorry. The talk on the Fae's manipulating people into doing what they want had me thinking two things. One, that they may or may not be trying to manipulate events, but I agree with them demanding that they not be perfect at it. Or, as Oshi says, how can he change his fate? The bit about Ryoka also had me thinking about, it's often talked about that the price, oh, wow, fucking Discanter, please, edit your work. The bit about Ryoka also had me thinking about, it's often talked about that the price for Mercia's life was the rest of the tribe. But the actual price, in quotation marks, was the goblin lord living. Zell and Ilvers were in position to kill him, but then the Fae intervention led them to cover the escape rather than finish the strike on the Goblin Lord, which also seemed to save some of the stone spears that would otherwise have died. On the Emperor story being written here, I just want to remind you that he lost a few poles before Pirate removed the choice and just set him up. So this was the latest Pirate wanted to let it go.
Interesting. One, be nicer to our editor, Oshi. I'm bad at it. I don't want to have to do it anymore.
Oh God, don't worry. I'm you know I how
We
much.
kid, we kid. That is interesting, though. I have a slightly different thought about that, which is that I think that a big part of the price was more everything that Mercia does afterwards when she would have died is, fundamentally things that wouldn't have happened afterward. Same for a bunch of other things. There's another big cost, though, because if that means that the Goblin Lord lived, then that means everything the Goblin Lord did after that would be the cost.
I think so, and I think that's what he's implying, is that the life of the Goblin Lord and the events and consequences of what happened there were the price that Ryoka paid in return for Mercia's life. And the bigger implication of this is that the Fae were able to see how everything intertwined, and they understood how even the butterfly wing, the butterfly effect. They change one tiny thing and they change the world. So they knew what that would be, and all they said was that there was a price and to asking the Fae for things, and here was the price. I don't know that Ryoka has internalized the reality of what of that, and I hope she never does because we got she's fucking Ryoka. We don't need her like bitching about more stuff that she thinks she caused. But this is one she actually did cause.
I mean, so at the end of the day, I think that maybe a tiny bit of angst would be appropriate, but I think that there's a lot of good that came from that decision too, which we'll talk about as we get to it.
Yeah.
But as for the Emperor thing, that's interesting because like I was not here back then, so I missed, I guess, what you would call the like actual logistical history of the votes and all of that. So I did not know the Emperor had been put off.
Okay, let me say that I was here for that. Here's the thing. There's a thread now in the Discord where there's somebody tracking when somebody finished things. The like it, I don't even know, reading room graduation lists or something, and as like the people who finish the fastest and people when they finish, and I discovered that I have been reading Wandering Inn since 2017. I by the way, I cannot remember anything about the year 2017. Depression is fucked. That's all I will say. What I do remember though is that I finished super fast because I'm a fast reader. I think I finished in a couple of days. But it was so long ago, there were barely anything. And I remember being here all that time, by the way, and the polls for the E stuff. But I will say this. I think it's unfair because I didn't have as much to read as quickly as some of these leaderboard people who are at the top. So I don't think it's fair to compare. Like, I only had a couple of million words. They had 10 million. And they had to read faster. It's not fair. I should be at the top of that list.
Well, like I came in, God, it was like right at the end of volume 5, like almost right dead on the end of the volume, and it took me maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks. I don't know. I just know that I was running behind on all my deliveries and ran over late for a whole bunch of stuff, and probably drove sleepier than I should have been because I was staying up all night reading Wandering Inn.
I barely left my bed for a few days. But that was just depression, maybe. I don't know. It was a combination of the two.
Well, that's the nice thing about phones and web serials. When you're too depressed to leave your bed, you can still do something.
Yeah, and the I love my laptop. And the point of all this is that I do remember Pyre creating a poll that literally just had E on it, and I had to do research backtrack through the poll for one of the after chapter discussion things. A name I hate and will forever hate. Yes, I hate. The whole thing was that Pyre added it as an option in the old days. There was a bunch of points, and there was a plot point that they wanted to get to, and I think it lost like three, four maybe polls, and then Pyre was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna write this, and you're just gonna accept it," and they just put down E for all 10. They made 10 options, and all of them were some variation of the letter E.
Pirate, you magnificent troll, never stop.
Okay, so oh, and we also had some commentary in from Debzeb on the Discord said, "Today I discovered a real geographical feature that must be what the Lyskor floodplains are. I heard about Lake Disappear, which is literally a disappearing and reappearing lake IRL. Geologists call it a P-O-L-J-E, pole lake. What it is that there's like a sinkhole underneath it. And once the water floods in over time, the sinkhole just draws away the water. And it's really cool as a geological feature. And there's a bunch in New Zealand, apparently.
Yeah, I'm looking it up now. This seems really interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to have to look that up more. That seems really cool.
I did look it up.
And certainly not potentially plot relevant at all.
I mean, what could happen? I mean, maybe Cold is right and there is a journey to the center of the Earth arc and there's a giant ocean underneath Lascaux. That could never be true.
Okay, a massive undersea ocean underneath Israel would be metal as fuck. I would absolutely be about that.
The big reason I think this might be true, like, assuming Pirate even looks at some of the things that we look at, you know there are giant aquifers under the Sahara Desert, right?
Yes, and...
And they're considered, like, fossil water because there's no replenishing of those aquifers. They're just... massive amounts of fresh water that are trapped from the eras when the Sahara was lush rather than a desert because of climate change.
There's multiple causes involved, especially when it comes to deserts, desertification, stuff like the Sahel. Like, it comes and goes, and climate change has definitely not helped. But it's kind of like we used to... I always get vaguely annoyed because you read about how they used to blame local people because they grazed too much, and that's why it's a drought. It's like, no, that's... Anyways.
Back to talking about media, because we gotta fill...
Yeah, this conversation, though, just reminded me of a book series I don't think I've talked about on here yet.
Oh, go ahead.
The Riria Revelations.
Ooh, good ones. Yeah.
I love that book series. It is... really cool, and I'm able to, I guess, just more talk about the first and maybe the second book a little.
Oh, the Riria Revelations are by Michael J. Sullivan. They're epic fantasy. I think there are six books in it.
Yeah, although it, like, gets compilated weirdly. There's also some prequel stuff.
They were originally self-pubbed, and I think they sold a whole lot, and then they got recollected as three, like, hardcover novels that you can buy.
Yeah, by the time I read it, it had been recompiled, because the first three, I think, got turned into the one book that's called Theft of Swords.
Yeah, that's probably it, yeah.
It is a really fun story. It's very sort of like a mix of high and low fantasy, following these two great characters named Hadrian and Royce. Hadrian and Royce are... basically, you know, thieves, although one of them in D&D terms is definitely a fighter, the other one's definitely a rogue. And unlike a lot of other fantasy stories, these guys are already, like, they've kind of made it. They're very talented, they're very skilled, they are, you know, not new at this. But because they're sort of known people and not new at this and good at their jobs, they wind up getting pulled into a bunch of crazy shenanigans, starting with, you know, murders and conspiracies, assassinations, giant magical dragons with, like, one of the coolest explanations for what a dragon is and how it works that I've ever, like, heard of. If you like fantasy, magic. It has a really cool explanation of magic stuff, wherein no amount of studying specific words and hand motions can make you a wizard. At the end of the day, all of that stuff is just the baseline, and if you're going to be a real wizard, you have to have that degree of getting it and artistic flair to how you do it. So, like, anyone can learn, but if you try and treat it like pure math and not like poetry, it's just not going to do anything. It's going to be a big... Sorry, I probably should actually plan more to talk about a book series I like this much before randomly thinking about talking about it.
You know what? Why don't we, like, just go, guys, go read it. Riera is great. Dragonus will talk about it and pontificate on it on another date when he has more, like, structured thoughts. How's that?
Oh, yeah. the thing that made me think about it, a couple later books involve the characters having to go on a sailing mission on a giant undersea under the continent sea that is incredibly fucking awesome.
Revelations, Michael J. Sullivan, epic fantasy, 3 novels. I'm not spelling that out for anybody. I know somebody was going to like type up the recommendations we had. It shows up in a lot of like best of fantasy in the last couple decades or something like that for epic fantasy stuff. So it's great. Check it out. I think they have audiobooks too for the audiobook listeners. So it's pretty good.
Yeah, actually, if you're the kind of person who leans towards not just audiobooks, but like the audio dramas, I think I've seen some audio dramas for it too. And those are always really good by the graphic audio people.
So speaking of epic fantasy stuff, I watched this YouTuber, Matt Books, I think. He's a booktuber. If anyone know what a booktuber is, like book talk and all that stuff. I don't think a lot of people who listen to us follow that shit, but if you do, and he's reading the next book in the Wandering Inn series. He's done volume 1 and 2. He's on volume 3. I can't wait to see what his opinion on it is. Matt, you should come listen to us if you ever want to talk about volume 3. So I know you talked about the Riera Revelations. Thank you. I know you talked about those books, but I have actually been super interested in a couple of anime, or at least catching up on one and rewatching another. So have you ever heard of Odd Taxi?
Yes.
I got someone who's a friend to watch it for the first time, and they literally tried to spit in my face because they thought it was going to be a nice slice of life, like happy thing, and it ended up being... They loved it, by the way. It ended up being completely different, this complex, multi-layered mystery. And I'm like, it technically was slice of life, right? Have you ever watched it?
Oh, yeah. No, I fucking love Odd Taxi. Odd Taxi is a happy story about a world where everyone are cute animals, and anyone who tells you otherwise is telling you the truth.
Yes, please go watch it.
it's actually like a really deep, almost sort of, it's almost Tarantino-esque with its plot.
It is. I think it is Tarantino. I think it's basically, not that they replicated what Tarantino does, but they replicated what a lot of like prestige filmmakers and TV makers nowadays do, where they create a layered plot based on a future event and then build everything around reaching that event.
It's good. It has like a really amazing, beautiful, stylized art style. Everybody's animals, and it's very funny. The characters are all charming. You're going to get really like caught up in this, and you will hate us for recommending it to you, but you'll love the anime.
Yes. And the other thing that I'm trying to sort of catch up on, or at least go back into, is Ranking of Kings.
Oh.
Yeah, I started Ranking of Kings, and I was like, okay, this requires a level of attention that I'm not giving it. So I paused it, and I think I paused it like either a couple episodes in or really far in. I can't remember because I wasn't properly paying attention. And I knew I was doing a bad job with this because I could feel myself wanting to connect, but I was just so tired or distracted that I just wasn't. And I was like, okay, I'm going to come back to this. So now I have the time. So this weekend, what I'm going to do is start watching Ranking of Kings. For those who don't know what Ranking of Kings is, it is the most surprising anime I have seen in a while. Oh, God, I don't even know how to describe it.
So Ranking of Kings is the story about a young boy who has several disabilities. He's deaf. I cannot remember like the whole list. His growth is very stunted. He is just in general the kind of person that in a world in the distant past where you're also the heir to the throne and the king is expected to be a talented, capable, and active combatant, people are not going to rank you terribly highly. And he is an adorable good boy, and the art style is very like classic-y.
Childlike. It's the stuff from the, like, you remember the Smurfs from the 90s, from the early...
Yeah, it's like Miyazaki-esque in that Western, like, children cartoons aesthetic as well, and the two combined to completely not tell you what a dark story this is.
Oh my god, yes! Okay, so there's like the art style is actually what makes it really, really good. Because you don't expect the kind of story that you get, and the way it's represented, and the way the animators play with the characters using the art style, it really works with it. And it's such a good fantasy setting. It's a very traditional, despite being an anime, it's very traditional fantasy setting. It's so wonderful. It really does have a Miyazaki feel to it. He's right.
Oh, did I say Miyazaki?
Yeah, you said Miyazaki.
There was somebody else that I'm thinking of, but I can't think of the name of that person.
Okay, I'm going to keep talking about it then. You know animes love their archetypes and tropes. Everything about this is the constant defiance of those stereotypes. I don't want to spoil too much, but it takes the cliches and just, like, trashes them. And does a really good thing. Like, being generic is, like, a good thing sometimes. There are lots of shows that do as generic well. Shonen animes, I'm talking about you, like, fucking Jujutsu Kaisen and all that shit. But Ranking of Kings avoids that and makes it a strength. And I loved it.
Yeah, and on the subject of, like, shonen-y stuff, that simplistic art style animates beautifully when it is time for somebody to throw some hands.
Yeah, and there is something about the way the action sequences, it just hits you. And then The other aspect is very wandering in that none of the characters, from what I remember, are black and white. Typically, shonen anime and even josei and like anything that's, except for like middle-aged men anime, you always have this, there's a couple of things. One, everybody has a particular spot they fail. They're good, they're bad, they're something. And the action takes precedence over everything else, and the little moments aren't important, and there's a lot of fan service, and everyone's evil just because they are evil. And none of this happens in this book. None of the young characters are annoying. And there's so much, and the biggest thing for me that I hate about anime, even the good animes, is that they do a lot of telling you things. Like, people narrate their emotions while the animation is showing that exact emotion.
Oh, yeah.
I feel nervous. I feel angry. Meanwhile, the animation is literally showing, like, what the fuck?
That can be a weird holdover from how, like, you know, in a manga, that stuff is being often narrated or described sometimes. This was the big problem with Record of Ragnarok, which is one of my favorite manga ever, but was one of the worst animated things I've ever seen in my life, because they did that so much and basically just took a flat manga page, colored it in poorly, stuck it on screen, and then had people narrate, which works in a manga, does not work in an anime.
It does not. Oh my god. This is why I loved Odd Taxi too, because the dialogue respected the idea that the animation would find a way to show the emotions, and they just spoke. The same thing here happens with Ranking of Kings. They just react and act as if they are people, and then the animation has to meet that challenge. They don't assume that the animation will fail, and thus they need to explicitly explain each and every emotion and talk through everything that they're feeling. They can just feel things. And they, oh god, there's so many,
that's definitely a problem, especially lower budget anime have, because they'll try to narrate in place of having to spend money on animation cells. Which, on the subject, though, just of anime, because I'm probably just going to be saying this every day for the rest of this anime season, if you're not watching Chainsaw Man, you're wrong.
Okay, whatever, we're moving on. Speaking of, like...
You do not whatever, Chainsaw Man.
Whatever. Speaking of really well done show don't tell things, the development of Leonette and Mercia, which are the subject of this episode, this is what we're going to talk about for volume 3.
Yeah, you want to talk about character development for somebody of royal personage.
Yeah, she's the exact, like, replication of, I don't even know how, like, look at where she started, look at where she ends up at the end of volume 3. Like, Leonette has her own, like, massive development. And along the way, we get a slice of what happens with Pawn and all the stuff that Mercia goes through with Leonette and how their relationship develops. Like,
Yeah, and honestly, there is, I think, a larger theme that becomes apparent across this. Because we've met, since you just made the noise, the right?
Yep.
You remember the which, for those who don't remember who the Ugg are, it's the Earthers that Magnolia has penned up. I can't help comparing them to Leonette a little because of, you know, this general idea and even what Aaron says about how, you know, or Ryoka said about how keeping them cooped up, somebody says something about how keeping them cooped up and stifling them and just kind of keeping them in a corner is not doing them any favors. Meanwhile, Leonette, who is also kind of stuck up and goes out into the world and basically gets her ass kicked and realizes she's either going to have to get her shit together or starve. You give somebody that opportunity and they can rise to it.
I mean, yeah. And there's softer ways to do that kind of grow up moment. This is probably not the best way. I mean, Aaron disappears. She's trapped in an abandoned inn with a little child who hates her and is starving to death. And she has no idea, nothing, no choice but to become, to take classes and to grow and become anything just to survive. Her first guest is, I mean, let's be fair, her first guest is awesome. I know we're supposed to talk about Leonette and Mercia, but let's not forget who her first guest is and her biggest cheerleader and supporter. Don't make me say it. You know who it is.
Pawn?
Pawn? No.
Was it not Pawn?
I mean, yes, Pawn, but that comes later. I meant, oh god, the general.
Zell. Oh, okay, you mean like her first, like, guest.
Yeah. He's also the one who actively defends her, remember, when Aaron gets back?
Yeah, but oh god, this getting from point A to point B there takes me a second, because I was still thinking about early on, when she really had nothing, and it was Alessum and Pawn coming in that sort of gave her that little bit of a lifeline.
Right, that's true, and I agree with that, but her first real guest, the person who connected with her the most and understood what she was, like, actually treated her like
an adult.
With the level of... Yeah, like, actually treated her like an adult, like a young mother, like a person, as the person she was becoming rather than the person that they met. Alyssum and Pawn, okay, Alyssum did it out of pity, let's be real. And in Pawn's case, he's just nice to, Pawn's nice to everybody. And I love Pawn, but there is something about his saint-like ability to just be willing to help everyone that makes it hard for him to, like, be that catalyst for another person. Meanwhile, Zell just saw this person struggling and doing the best she could and respected her as that, was kind to the kid that she was carrying around, and was kind to her. Genuinely because he could. Fucking Zell is a hero, man. Even in, that alone.
Yeah, no. So there is a quote that specifically comes to mind for me from Order of the Stick, and I apologize because I don't remember the exact wording, so I will probably wind up misquoting this. But it's the nice thing about meeting new people is they don't know who you used to be. And that really is, I think, the trick with Leonette here. Like, Pawn really barely knows anyone, so when he meets Leonette, he's kind of giving her this fresh start of a new person. And Zell truly has no idea who she is, and he, you know, assumes she has her life together. And getting treated like an adult and being forced to make her own way. And she did get really creative there, too.
Yeah.
With stuff like getting the honey.
Oh my god, that had to be one of the bravest things she did. Because I know she had no choice, but even thinking... She's not Aaron. Getting herself to the point where she walked into a hive of super bees after making them fall asleep with what is essentially crazy dust... I mean, girl had some balls, I gotta say it. She had some balls. Or maybe, better I should say, she stepped her pussy up, right? That was big.
Yeah, and also, she did it almost not even for herself. She did it for...
Mercia.
Yeah. Right? And I think it speaks to something that a lot of like this pompous, royal turn up your nose peon stuff. She has also internalized this idea of like, I'm responsible for this person. I have to help them. And honestly, once she kind of gets over herself and eats the humble pie, she becomes really competent and capable of doing so.
And then, of course, I mean, there is that internal moment where she like confronts the fact. There's a set of three chapters that are labeled L. And there's a bunch. Actually, there's a one more before that. But there's a set of three chapters that are important that are like L chapters that develop a little bit of how Leonette treats with Zevra, like, and with Pawn. Pawn especially. Like, do you want to talk about Pawn?
Oh, do I want to talk about Pawn?
Go ahead.
Pawn is great in this book. Just in general, across this book, I appreciate how much Pawn is just having to learn and understand and cope with the concept of faith and the really terrible explanation of religion that he got from Aaron.
And then in the chapters, one of Leonette's chapters is literally Zurn and Kilvickich almost meeting up with Zell, who was pissed at them. Like that confrontation was so good.
Oh, yeah. But, like, I was thinking about the pawn thing. Like, Aaron just sort of casually, in this way of, like, maybe somebody who's been raised at church and does not quite really grasp the danger of the words, gives faith to pawn. And this is giving it to the Antinium, who truly have nothing but to believe. And, oh boy, would it help to get a more complete explanation in that case.
Yeah, and we don't really have an episode set aside for the Antinium, so I'm okay talking about the Antinium now. But even in relation to how you see Pawn independently acting, he goes around, he explores his surroundings, he explores what's possible, he explores his position in the hive, and he begins to form relationships independent of Aaron, specifically with Leonette, and then with Olesen, later with different individuals, right? And it's very childlike in nature, and yet this becomes a running theme that the Antinium are so evolved because they get so many advantages when they're born, and yet they have the childlike naivete and the kind of sense of children have this thing where they just take everything as it is. They don't have already formed opinions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they're impressionable.
Even impressionable doesn't really quantify it. It's this sense that, okay, here's how I think of it. I'm gonna frame it in my personal terms. A kid is not born knowing the difference between a gay person, a straight person, a lesbian, and a non-binary person. We'll say that. There's no knowledge inbuilt. Something has to be taught for them to understand those definitions that we come up with for each other. If a kid with no definitions met anyone of a different thing, and they didn't know about what the difference between like loving someone with the same sex or otherwise, and somebody just answered the question and says, this is the person that I love and this is the person I spend time with, they would have no definition for how the structures work, and they would be like, okay, that's what they love. That's how it's supposed to be. And that is how Pawn treats the entire world. He's not stupid. He understands lies and things, and that not everybody's out for the best because he's suffered before. And he's lost, but he still treats people from that perspective. And that is so precious. And it just does not happen a
It
lot.
is, and it's why, like, it's sad to see Pawn put in this position where he's commanding these soldiers, and, like, he can't help them, and he's trying to help them, but they don't even have a voice. Like, it is an actual, like, crime to me. I very much despise the Queens, because they've made these soldiers who are people, and they have no voice.
Yes. And that was really cool development. And having Pawn reach out to Leonette, and Leonette actively like trying to understand. She's the one who understands. She's the first. It's easy for us to forget that the rest of the world already has formed opinions about the Antinium. And here's Leonette, who is decidedly has a preformed opinions told by others and other things, and yet she's the one who reaches out and is accepting of them, partly because they're saving her, but she's also learning to do what, or at least discovering within herself that ability to see a person as a person and without judging their outside or their station or anything else. And that's huge for somebody of her background.
Yeah, and you know, this is interesting to me too, the way that her character development ties in with the fact that acting more like a person and, you know, providing care and taking care of herself, taking care of Mercia, working at the inn, forming these business and personal relationships, gets her levels, which she's ecstatic about because she hadn't leveled in years and years and years. And now she's got two classes and a bunch of levels. And it's like the system is actively, in a Pavlovian way, rewarding her for being better. It's like tangible reward. It's like, you know, I'm on my diet right now, and if I could level up tomorrow and just wake up knowing I'm a pound lighter than I was yesterday, and that the universe is rewarding me by giving me the dieter class, it would be so much easier.
Yeah, it's interesting commentary as well on the social pressure for Leonette to level up in her primary class and only level up in these classes and only level up a certain way and only evolve in a certain thing. It's very much like social commentary on how even in a world with that collectively wants people to get levels and things, you're only allowed to do certain things a certain way even here. It's still, like, society has rules, and your family has rules, and you can't take barmaid classes! How could you?
It was an interesting contrast with what they had for Kershaya when Ryoka and Kershaya were talking about the way levels work. Where Kershaya's like, yeah, we try not to influence our children's levels too much. You know, we want them to kind of find what they're good at, and they might be afraid to experiment and be better if they knew they were making it harder to level later on, that kind of a thing.
Mm.
And here we have Leonette, who's been raised with this idea that her levels are precious and specific, and she should be careful what she takes, because she needs to have a specific class, and other stuff she gets had better also be of the correct peerage, maybe. I don't think she said that specifically, but the implication was there.
Yeah, the implication was there. And then, as the volume progresses, we eventually have Erin comes back to the inn, and there's like...
I want to talk about a Mercia moment pre-Erin that I think is, well, two really, but because it is during this period when Erin is gone that Mercia, while playing around with some paint and one of the soldiers the pawn's been bringing to the inn, which is actually kind of interesting as too, now that I think about it, that Leonette really, without even meaning to, carried on the bringing Antinium to the inn as like a big customer base thing.
I just said that, yeah, like her reaching out to the Antinium, partly in desperation, of course, but that was important, yeah.
Probably partly in desperation. I just hadn't considered the continuity of it. But no, Mercia paints one of the Antinium. It gets white paws all over it.
And that is another aspect of it. Pirate used Mercia, this childlike person. Children can be annoying. Let's be real. Children can be annoying, and they can be disruptive, but that's because... that's how they are. But Mercia becomes this sort of evolving figure and representative of children. And she's literally only one who gets to be a child here, despite her extreme trauma. And she does these simple things and simple acts. She just wants to be loved and cared for and for people not to, like, run away or go away. Ryoka does it all the time, hurting her. But here's Leonette offering to care for her. Here's Pawn being kind to her. Here's Zell treating her well. Like, all of these people, she's rebuilding some of the connections, and children being resilient after trauma, she's rebuilding those connections.
Yeah, and in doing so, as we see, like, the next L chapter right after it, like, she creates something really special among the Antinium. Pawn takes literally every drop of paint they have home, talks Kilbekich into letting him paint more of them, and paints the Antinium.
And that's one of the most significant moments in the Antinium's growth, because Pawn finally figures out a way to give individuality to the voiceless.
Yeah.
To give them a chance to evolve.
And incidentally, on the subject of what Discanter said and what I was talking about, Leonette probably does not grow into this person that she becomes without Mercia to give her something to care for and invest in. The Antinium don't get painted without Mercia. Like already barely a book later, not even, and we're already seeing massive consequences.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's there's a ripple effect. Butterfly effect happens. So yeah, Mercia treats Leonette more and more like her caregiver, and then I don't know, just as that person that you look to, you're let's say it. She's starting to treat her a little like Leonette's her mom, right?
Yeah.
They're not there yet, but I think that's what's going to it. And as the volume up progresses, Erin comes back to the inn, which is Leonette is sort of running by herself at this point, and then Erin tries to attaches the door to Selim and hires barmaids and tries to evolve the inn, and she's terrible at it.
Yeah. Erin is a fly by the she makes me think of those people that fly by the seat of their pants, come up with an idea, make a business, and then don't actually understand anything about business. They just had a great idea and a winning personality.
Yeah, and they get really, really far, but then without the right support, they collapse.
Yeah, and Leonette steps in as the perfect counterpoint and balancing weight with Erin to, handle the logistics and put the stuff together if only Erin would let her. And like you were saying earlier, one of my favorite moments in this whole volume turned out to be Zelle Shivertail telling Erin off, saying listen, this girl, I don't know what the hell was gone on with you before, but since I've been here, she's been professional. I'm Zelle motherfucking Shivertail. I could stay anywhere, and I stay here because of her. Like, she has put work in. Respect her.
Yeah, and that moment of Zell standing up for Leonette and for what happens afterwards once Erin recognizes the kind of things that she's failing to do, which is to, I'm not gonna get treated well for saying this, but Erin has some really good sense of people, but sometimes her blind spots are giant, and oftentimes it's because she's really rigid in her opinions. And Leonette kind of,
She's judgmental.
I was trying to avoid saying those words because, yeah, but yeah, she's judgmental. And so when she does make up for it and she does apologize, and Leonette is more integrated into the inn, it's good in a lot of ways, the way she grows into her place. And it's good that Erin has her, but from the beginning, the fact that she's a princess put I'm like, how the fuck did Erin manage to luck into having a princess as her barmaid? And speaking of Erin and Leonette's relationship.
Yeah, well, if you want to talk about the word luck, most people wouldn't have described it that way at the time. She took on the burden of having that person as her barmaid. And then it turned out that, you give people a little bit of faith and put the effort in, and they turn out all right. Even if, and yes, I don't see a way to. Erin being judgmental is actually not, inherently bad. In the sense, we all have to use our judgment. We all have to, recognize toxic people, recognize the people that are good for us. The problem is, like you said, she's a very good grasp of people, and when she grasps quickly that you're kind of a piece of shit, she's not letting it go for a while, and that's very much to her detriment.
So one of the things, Erin and Leonette's evolution as a working pair is a journey in and of itself, because really neither of them have ever run an inn before, right? She's a princess. Erin's a kid from Michigan who plays chess. That they don't know what the fuck they're doing, right?
Yeah, and Leonette has vaguely mentioned siblings and not in a good, appreciatory way. Erin is mostly an only child. And the two of them, by the end of this volume, feel like they're very much approaching a very sisterly feeling with one another. And that's rough for both of them because, I mean, neither one of them's great with people and, yeah, Erin can put on a big bombastic charismatic show, but her interpersonal relationships leave a bit to be desired. And Leonette's just thorny.
Also, she's kind of she knows how to rule. She doesn't know how to structure things. I doubt she knows basic accounting or how to keep books or how to get supplies or things. But she does know how to talk to people and to get to, like, the point where she can connect. And she can make her... She's learning from Eren, too, right? So it's a good relationship, and it does begin in this volume. And I do really think Leonette's journey from bratty child to more self-aware and young adult is really... It's a good story. I love it.
Yeah, and... Just, I think the last thing to talk about is I think a bit more about Mercia, because I think that it's not quite as bad when Eren's gone, because, like, just nobody is around. But she is still, I think, getting a bit of crap in this volume from Knowles, who are a little,
Yeah.
What's the word?
Intolerant?
Intolerant, yeah, no, intolerant feels like it's the most appropriate. I was having trouble thinking of it, but...
Yeah, they're... Mercia is an interesting case of a character that is so young, and she's sort of on the edges of all of... There's no POV from her in this volume, and you sort of stay on the edges of her. Instead, things are happening to her, and she's so young, she doesn't know how to process any of it. And like I said, she takes everything as is. Here, she's just... She doesn't have a voice. Nobody has given her a way to speak. I was like, okay, she doesn't have a voice. Somebody's going to teach her, like, sign language, right? And then I realized nobody in this world has a structured sign language.
No, which also, God, that just occurred to me. It makes sense that Mercia is the one who helped the Antinium gain a voice, but, yep. You know, she still didn't have one after.
Yeah, that kind of... I just always wondered about why Pirate took so long to, like, get sign language as a thing. I still don't understand. It makes me wonder just how bad it must be for those who are blind or who are mute or otherwise have certain senses or abilities that are impaired in some way.
Yeah. Although, God, when you look at Laken, though, you have to wonder, like, if it's difficult for the will for a systemic solution, like an invented sign language universal enough that you could travel and still be able to use it, or go somewhere to be able to use it. When...
Hang on a second. Everybody speaks English, so whatever sign language would use the same... Like, English, right? The English vernacular?
Okay, but does that mean that if I go and, like, invent sign language in-world and I live in Ballaros, that everybody just suddenly knows it? Like, that's what I'm talking about. And when, you know, there's always that possibility that some person randomly levels and now they can perfectly read lips or something because, you know, they're married.
Well, that's the other aspect, is that I know Mercia's very, very young, but this is a pretty severe disability. You would think the system would grant some kind of skill that lets her get around it?
Maybe. Like, we know that the system helped out Laken, but Laken is both a very high level, or a high tier. He's an emperor, right? That's a big class. He had a more specific and immediate need, whereas Mercia, she can get along just fine without her voice, except for, you know, that time she almost died from it. But in her day-to-day life, it's not quite as bad as, say, being blind. So maybe... God, there's just too many questions about the system. Because I am betting that it's possible for her to get a skill that would do that, but maybe she's not in the right classes. Or maybe she's just not high enough level, she's too young. There could be several magical solutions or spells that could fix this, and the ability to, say, cast a spell to let someone talk means that people would prefer to just pay for that than teach sign language.
And I do wonder a lot about, like, why Leonette, who comes from... I mean, she's casually mentioned that she's from a privileged background. That generally means that they have more... In a world like that's very medieval, they'd have access to more knowledge and more understanding of how the class and system works. But because, of course, they will hoard knowledge. And I wondered why she couldn't think of anything to help Mercia. I don't know. There's a lot of, like, question marks when it comes to Mercia's...
It sucks to say this out loud, but part of me wonders if it's not because of the fact that other people see Mercia and perceive her as just not having as much trouble as somebody who's, say, blind or deaf. Which sucks, because it's... You really can't, like, quantify that kind of thing. But with the way that the system works, that could matter.
Okay. You had a second point about Mercia before we wrapped up.
Well, whatever it was, I lost it.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed. If you have more commentary on Mercia and Leonette's development in The Wandering in Volume 3, don't hesitate to send us some emails, give us something to chat about, and we'll see you next week. Say bye, Dragoness.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next week.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins.
Edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S at gmail.com.